the afternoon session with the first of the lectures by Clay Cordova.
Thank you very much. Okay, so my lectures will be an introduction to anomalies in quantum field theory and some of their elementary applications. And today we'll start very concrete, very low tech, with a kind of invitation which will be about degenerate ground states in quantum mechanics. So this will be the subject today, and we'll just mostly focus on some simple examples and try to see some interesting phenomena that we'll later abstract into a more general framework. So what will be the setup? We will have a Hilbert space which I'll call W. Simple examples, you might think W is square integrable functions. The quantum states are unit vectors in W, modulo an equivalence. The equivalence is familiar. It's W1 is considered the same as W2. If W1 differs from W2 by a phase. So alpha here is some real number. And this is because, as is familiar in quantum mechanics, transition probabilities are insensitive to these overall phases. So two such states related in this way describe the same underlying physical configuration. We also have time evolution. Previously, we heard about that in the kind of cobordism picture. We'll be very explicit. This will be generated by a self-adjoint positive Hermitian operator. The Hamiltonian, H, which is equal to H dagger. So I'm in the unitary setting, the most well-studied physical context. And we'll work in the Heisenberg picture, where we have operator evolution. So an operator at time t is generated from the operator at time zero by conjugation. Okay, so that's the setup for quantum mechanics. So the Hilbert space is given, the Hamiltonian is given. This is how time evolution is generated. What do we want to study? Well, in this talk, what we're going to study are the eigenvalues of H. We'll call them EI. These are energies, physically, and their multiplicity is the same thing as the degeneracy of the number of physically inequivalent states at a fixed energy level. So this will be the primary thing that we're interested in. And in particular, when physics, we're often not interested in all the energies, but the state of lowest energy, which is the ground state. So we're most interested in the ground state. Of smallest e. So smallest eigenvalue. Okay. What kind of question do we want to ask about this ground state? So So what we'll focus on today is the question of the degeneracy of the ground state. So here's a question. When is the ground state degenerate? When is there multiplicity at the lowest eigenvalue level for the Hamiltonian? And a closely related question that we'd like to investigate is the degeneracy, if we find any, stable under deforming the Hamiltonian? So this is the kind of main theme of this lecture, is these questions. Now, just to give you a feeling about this problem, let me give you a kind of example with a little theorem. So an example, kind of most familiar class of examples in quantum mechanics that are most well studied by physicists, is we have n particles moving on the line R. Okay, so the Hilbert space W will be square integral functions on R n, because we have n particles. What is the Hamiltonian? The Hamiltonian for this sort of situation will be minus sum from I is 1 to n of d squared dxi squared. So this is the kind of momentum piece. We have a Laplacian. And then we also have plus a function of the variables xi, which is the potential piece. So this is the most well-studied class of examples in quantum mechanics. It's what you find in the first couple chapters of any quantum mechanics textbook. And the reason I bring it up in this context is that there's an interesting little theorem. So let's first take the potential V to be greater than or equal to zero. That's no real loss in generality. We want the Hamiltonian to be bounded from below, so we shift it up so that V is near zero, V is bounded below by zero. So let's suppose this is true. And let's say that V is fairly well behaved. So we'll imagine that V is in L2 loc of Rn. That means that it is integrable, square integrable, on compact sets. So whatever singularities it can have are very mild because of that. On any compact set in Rn, you can integrate the square of V. And further, we'll also assume that V goes to infinity as x goes to infinity. So that kind of confines the particles, doesn't let them easily escape out to infinity. Okay, so given these hypotheses, what can you conclude? What you conclude is that H has a non-degenerate ground state. Okay, so I'll leave the proof of this as an exercise or homework. It is actually not that hard. But if you want help, you can see, read Simon. They have these tomes. It's in the fourth tome, somewhere in chapter 8. So this theorem tells you that it's not actually so trivial to produce degenerate ground states in quantum mechanics. The most simple class of examples that you would study, free particles with a potential, as long as the potential is not too badly behaved, you're always going to have a unique ground state.
Okay. When you say in the second question, stable under deforming H, what kind of deformations are you thinking of?
Perhaps let me answer that question later in the context of some examples. Loc means square integrable on compact sets. So if I deleted the loc, that just means it's square integrable. Here, this means that you can take V and square it and integrate it, and it has to have a finite integral on any compact set in Rn. So, you know, this theorem has many consequences that one is familiar with from elementary quantum mechanics. Probably the most familiar is that if you draw something like a double well potential, so, for example, any double well, has a unique ground state. Very naively, when you first studied this problem, you think, okay, there could be some state that's roughly localized here and some state that's roughly localized here, and maybe the Z2 symmetry of this problem would tell you that there should be two states. But in fact, a consequence of this theorem is that there's exactly one ground state. The physics behind that is tunneling. Okay, so just I give this theorem to you as a to motivate you to realize that making degenerate ground states is not so easy. We're going to have to work harder. And so what will be kind of a big picture goal for these lectures is we're going to develop a theory of invariance . These invariants have the name anomalies that, among other things, imply robust degenerate ground states. So that's what they do in quantum mechanics. And at the same time of developing this theory of invariance, we'll generalize it to quantum field theory. So we'll see also generalizations to quantum field theory. And here the word robust is supposed to indicate that stable under some kind of deformations property. Okay, so a key role in this theory of anomalies will be played by symmetries. In quantum mechanics, we have two varieties. That we'd like to investigate. And I'll give you some concrete examples of anomalies for both kinds here. So one are unitary transformations. So U is a unitary that maps from W to W, the Hilbert space, back to itself. And to say that it is a symmetry means that it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And the second class is always a little trickier. These are anti-unitary. So I'll call it T. Again, it goes from W to W. It commutes with the Hamiltonian, but now it is anti-unitary. So T acting on lambda W is lambda bar T of W. So we're talking about a complex Hilbert space here. So we can distinguish between maps which are linear over complex numbers and those which are anti-linear. Why do we call it T? Well, physically, any such anti-unitary symmetry is always related to time reversal symmetry in quantum mechanics. These symmetries will act on operators by conjugation. So O will transform to U, O, U inverse. And what we're going to do is to develop these invariants, these anomalies, from a careful investigation of the action of the symmetries on the Hilbert space. And we will be very concrete in our first couple investigations of this. Okay, any questions? Yeah, excellent. So, I mean, this is quite...
Can you repeat the question?
The question was, why does the double well have a unique ground state? It is very surprising if you've never studied it explicitly. You can make a state which, you know, if you zoom in close to any minimum here, it looks quadratic, which looks like the harmonic oscillator. So you could maybe put like a little Gaussian wave function here. And it doesn't really seem sensitive to... anything outside its little local neighborhood. So you might think that there's approximately some Gaussian here and some Gaussian here, and those are two states. But in fact, the true ground state is the linear superposition of them. And the difference between them, so the sum with the plus sign versus sum with the minus sign, have slightly different energies. And those energies can be calculated through tunneling. So that's like the first instance of instantons in quantum theory, is to calculate them. Yeah, and one consequence of the theorem that I erased is it's not a feature of the shape of the double well. Any double well will have that feature. More questions? Okay, so we're
Sorry,
going to get...
Sorry, I have a question here in the chat. Earlier statement, in the anomaly statement, does symmetry breaking necessarily imply ground state degeneracy? For example, symmetry breaking may result in Goldstone modes, or just gapless just mean degeneracy.
There's a question about symmetry break, spontaneous symmetry breaking, I think. What this theorem is supposed to tell you, one thing it tells you in particular, is that it's hard to break symmetry spontaneously in quantum mechanics. The naive thing to say is that in this problem, there is a Z2 symmetry, and there could be a state here and a state here, and that would spontaneously break that Z2 symmetry and would have led to indeed two degenerate states, which were permuted by that Z2. But the theorem tells you that those are not the ground states. Those are not energy eigenstates. So that's one of the consequences of the theorem, is that it's actually hard to break symmetry spontaneously in quantum mechanics. So that part of what we're going to develop, if you like, is a theory for in what way can symmetry be spontaneously broken in quantum mechanics? How do you circumvent this theorem? Yeah. Let me not say they're not there.
Again, can you repeat the question?
The question was, why do I restrict to unitary or anti-unitary? Isn't this whole collaboration about something more general? And indeed, it is about something more general. But for this lecture, and for most of my lectures, I'll be content to stay in the sort of more vanilla invertible setting and see what the invariants are there, where there's a very well-developed theory. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to try and show you some examples of invariants here. And I won't even yet tell you how to unify them into some bigger picture. Any other questions?
I have a question about that theorem.
Yeah.
Does it still hold if you replace R to the N with a different Riemannian manifold?
It holds if you replace it with, say, a compact set.
What if, like, does the topology matter?
Well, a hard wall with a sufficiently general, I mean, I'm not an expert, but I think a sufficiently general hard wall could imitate the Laplacian on a compact manifold.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, so we're going to do two examples where we're going to discover some invariants, one for an explicit example having to do with unitary symmetry, and one, if hopefully there'll be time to do the anti-unitary symmetry as well. So both of these are in a sense well known, but they're good appetizers to this general theory. So the first example that has to do with unitary symmetry is the particle in a circle. So our variable x will now be periodic with 2 pi periodicity. What is the Lagrangian? We'll have a standard kinetic term, half x dot squared. And then we'll add something kind of interesting, a theta term. So here theta, which is periodic, is a parameter. So what I've given you here is a circle's worth of quantum mechanics problems, a one parameter family of quantum mechanics. Okay, so from the Lagrangian, one can do a canonical transformation and get the Hamiltonian. That's a standard trick. So this implies that the Hamiltonian H, thought of as a differential operator, is 1/2 minus I d dx minus theta over 2 pi all squared. And it's supposed to act on functions on the circle now. So this is a quadratic Lagrangian, more generally a quadratic Hamiltonian. And so it's easy to just explicitly solve this. Can just write down the answer for all the energy levels, all the eigenstates, et cetera, all at once. And we're going to discover something kind of interesting. So what are the eigenfunctions? Anybody who has not seen this can tell me what the eigenfunctions of this operator are. What? Language? Plane waves. Plane waves. Yeah, plane waves. Yeah, good. Even easier though, because we're on a circle. So Fourier modes. Right? So the eigenfunctions. These look like exp of I n x, where n is an integer labeling the eigenfunction. And the energy, the eigenvalue, you just plug in here, and you find that it's equal to 1/2 n minus theta over 2 pi squared. All right, I solved this quantum mechanics. What is there to say? Well, we'll see. So I advertise that this is a one-parameter family of quantum mechanics, and the family comes back to itself when theta goes to theta plus 2 pi. You can also see that in the energy spectrum. If you shift theta by 2 pi, the energy spectrum is periodic, but the individual states reshuffle, so n gets moved around. So there's some kind of spectral flow under the motion in theta. And it's actually useful to make a plot of the energies. So maybe some of the mathematicians remember what a plot is. Here's energy, and here's theta. Here's 0. Here's 2 pi. Here's the middle. OK, so at theta equals 0, what's going on? So at theta equals 0, you go over here, you put theta equals 0. The ground state has n equals 0. And excited states, that is, the states that are energy eigenvalues with energy eigenvectors with which are not the ground state, these are doubly degenerate. So corresponding to plus and minus n for n absolute value greater than 0. So we can make a little plot over here. So here's our ground state. Here's, say, n is plus and minus 1. Here's n is plus and minus 2. N equals 0. And of course, at 2 pi, we have the same theory back. So the spectrum looks the same, though the labels get reshuffled. Now, I'd like to focus your attention not just on theta equals 0, but on another point, which is theta equals pi, the middle value. Now, what happens there? Well, we can draw a plot of the energies. So n equals 0, as you send theta from 0 to 2 pi, its energy rises. So this state, if you track it as an eigenvector, comes up like this. And one of the states over here must come down to be the ground state. So there's a plot like that. And this was supposed to be exactly lined up. And similarly, the other state over here comes up there. This one comes down here. Okay, my aim is all off. Let's try again. Thank you. So here's theta equals pi. And the magic thing that is happening there is that all energy eigenvalues are doubly degenerate. Including, in particular, the ground state. So we would like to know why. So let me first tell you a wrong idea. The wrong idea is maybe.
I have a question, sorry. So in what sense the theta is 2 pi periodic?
Sorry, what is the question?
In what sense the 2 pi parameter is 2 pi periodic?
The spectrum of the Hamiltonian returns to itself?
I don't think Hamiltonian returns itself. It's just equivalent. It has the same spectrum, but it's a different operator.
So it's different by conjugation. But
yeah, so in what's the existence by saying that 2 pi the theta is periodic?
Well, for instance, the spectrum is the same, and it differs by conjugation by a unitary operator.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so the wrong idea is that you might say if you first encounter this this picture, in particular if you zoom in just on the degeneracy of, say, one of the levels, say the ground state, you might say maybe level crossing is generic in a one-parameter family. So that, I emphasize, is not the explanation. It is not correct to think that level crossing is generic in a one-parameter family of operators. And in fact, for homework, let me emphasize another homework problem. Determine the codimension of level crossing loci. In a multi-parameter H. So if you solve that problem, you will see that this is not the right explanation of this phenomenon. In fact, something more subtle is happening. So I advertised the symmetries. So let's talk now about the symmetries. So what are the symmetries of this problem? There are two that we are interested in. One is that there is a shift symmetry. So you can take the variable x, and you can replace it by x plus a, where a is a time-independent constant. So this defines unitaries u sub a, one for each a. And because x is periodic with period 2 pi, a is also periodic with period 2 pi. And this, therefore, these unitaries form the group u1 under composition. That is the first class of symmetries. And these symmetries exist for any value of the parameter theta. The second class of symmetries are reflections. I will call them C. How do they act on the variable x? They send x to minus x. This is a symmetry only at theta equals 0 or pi. The fact that it is a symmetry at theta equals 0 is manifest from the Lagrangian. If you set theta to 0 and you put x to minus x, the Lagrangian stays the same. The fact that the reflection C is a symmetry at theta equals pi requires a little more thought. Here, this term is invariant, and this term seems to change sign. But because pi and minus pi are conjugate modulo 2 pi, it is in fact a symmetry. So here we're using the periodicity of the theta parameter. So this is a symmetry at theta equals pi. Since pi equals minus pi mod 2 pi. So there are two distinguished instances of this quantum mechanics, one at theta equals 0 and the other at theta equals pi, where there is an enhanced symmetry. How do these symmetries act on the states? So if we call Wn the state vector with a wave function exp inx, then ua on Wn, well, we know how ua acts on x, and so we see how it acts on this wave function. Like so, multiplies it by an n-dependent phase. What about reflection? Reflection is a bit more subtle. So at theta equals 0, C on Wn is equal to W minus N, whereas at theta equals pi, C on Wn is W minus N plus 1. So the action on the labels is slightly more subtle. And you can check that in my way of labeling the states, Wn and W minus n plus 1 are indeed the states that are degenerate in pairs. So those are the ones being related by the action of this symmetry. Okay, so another exercise. Convince yourself that this is how C acts. Okay, so these are the symmetries. We have this group U1, which is the same as SO2. And we have this reflection symmetry C at theta equals 0 and pi. And now let's ask ourselves a seemingly benign question. What group? Is formed or generated, I should say, by UA and C. Seems like a vanilla question. But it has two different answers, depending on exactly what version of the question you mean. Okay, answer one . So by construction, you could say when acting on operators, operators are generated by X and derivatives with respect to X and compositions thereof. So by constructing, when acting on operators, you realize the group O2. After all, this is SO2, rotations of the circle, and C is reflections on that circle. And by definition, that is O2. And that is indeed what you find acting on the operators. But there's a second answer that you find when you investigate how the symmetries act on the states. And let me emphasize the place where we'll find an interesting answer. So answer two acting on states at theta equals pi, we find an additional phase. So let's investigate C, UA, C inverse, acting on the vector WN. We have all the definitions we need over here. In the group O2, this would have been U of minus A acting on WN. That's the definition of the group relations in O2. But here, we don't find that. So we're working at theta equals pi. We use that second formula. We generate some phase by acting with UA on this state vector. And this is the same as e to the IA acting on U times U minus A on WN. So what we thought we would get if we really had O2 acting on the states was C UA C inverse is equal to U of minus A. Instead, what we found is almost that relation, but extended by something centrally, by a phase. What is this? Well, it's a central extension, so it's a projective representation. This is a projective representation associated to a double cover. What's the double cover? It's Z2 goes into pin minus 2, projects down to O2. So what we found is that when acting on operators, you see O2. When acting on states, you see this double cover. Okay, I'll now make a bunch of comments. Probably there are questions. See if they are answered by the comments, and then barrage with more questions. Okay, comments. Why was this discrepancy between states and operators possible? Is possible because states are rays. States are not vectors in the Hilbert space, but they are rays. There is that phase equivalence relation that I emphasized at the beginning. Now we're seeing a subtle consequence of that in practice. So this means that we can have a cocycle in the multiplication. That's called the cocycle mu. It's a group cohomology cocycle, so it's an O2 with coefficients in U1. We want to be off by a phase. We found such a thing where the U we only realized a Z2 subgroup of U1. So this is possible in the multiplication. And I emphasize that the operators are blind to mu, so effectively have mu equals zero, because they transform by conjugation. Okay, so that's first comment. Second comment, all states have the same cocycle. So this is not just a property of an individual energy eigenlevel. It is a property of the entire Hilbert space. Since all states have the same mu, and operators effectively realize mu equals zero, that means the operators can act transitively on all the states. They fix mu. Hello, nice to see you. Maybe we can mute him. We can't mute him?
The host can.
Who is the host? Okay. We'll see, we'll hear what's going on for dinner at their house. Okay, so theta equals zero has mu equals zero, and theta equals pi has mu non-zero. Okay, and the final comment, which we'll circle back to the main first question that we asked at the beginning of this talk about degeneracy, is that each eigenspace, bend all the way down there. Each eigenspace of H forms a projective representation with the given mu. And in particular, if mu is not equal to zero, so if the cocycle is non-trivial, that's the situation at theta equals pi. This implies that the dimension of each eigenspace must be larger than one. So this is the advertised degeneracy that we saw at theta equals pi. Why is that? Well, it's just because of this extremely basic fact that there's no such thing as a one-dimensional projective representation. So projective representations, like we have encountered here, are the easiest examples of anomalies. Both in quantum mechanics and in QFT, they're the easiest examples. And they are also robust. Under symmetry-preserving deformations. So if you modify the Hamiltonian, you can keep this degeneracy. Let me give you a homework problem related to that.
Can you just say again why mu not equals zero?
A projective representation is a representation where the mistake you make is by a phase. But if it's one-dimensional, the group is acting only by phases. So you're not making a mistake. Okay, so the homework. Here's an example of this robustness. Let's take our same particle on the circle, and let's modify the Hamiltonian by adding to it a potential. Lambda over 2 pi cosine of 2x. So this is the Hamiltonian that we had for the particle on the circle, and we add this new term. With lambda here, a new parameter. So the homework has two parts. Part one, show that for small lambda, at theta equals zero, the splitting between the plus one and minus one eigenstates is lambda, up to order lambda squared. So you remember that at theta equals zero, plus one and minus one were exactly degenerate. But here you see that that was kind of an accident. We could just turn on a potential and split them as we like. But you can also prove that for all lambda, at theta equals pi, the degeneracy persists. So someone asked me previously, what did I mean by deformation invariant or robust degeneracy? Here is an example. This problem, once you turn on lambda, is no longer exactly solvable. It's a very complicated problem. We don't know what the exact energies are, but we can still prove that the energy levels are doubly degenerate, at least. Questions? What does that mean? They're degenerate. You're talking about the first case at theta equals zero? What? The zero point energy can move, but there will still be at least two ground states. There's not an analog of clustering in quantum mechanics. Any other questions?
Yeah, so the first thing that I would try and do to see if you're right to check whether there's a projective representation of O2 corresponding to this extension with pin minus at theta is equal to pi, is to pick a lift of a reflection, so to check if C squared is equal to the identity or minus the identity. But it seems to be squaring to the identity, right?
That's why I put pin minus, yeah.
There is a question in the chat, Clay. Wouldn't the cosine 2x term break this chief symmetry?
Good, yes. Indeed, the cosine 2x term breaks the shift symmetry. You cannot shift x by an arc, but the most of the UA operators are no longer symmetries. But a shift by half the period is still allowed. And that is all that is needed to ensure the degeneracy.
So Clay, maybe follow up from the beginning of the thing when you have the questions. The deformations that you want to in H are these kind of deformations or where?
So for instance, this kind of deformation here by lambda. So this is away from being exactly solvable. We don't know exactly what the energy eigenvalues are, but we can still prove degeneracy using some kind of using this projective representation argument. Any other questions? Oh boy. How late did we start?
We still have 10 minutes?
10 minutes. All right, we'll fly. Okay. Okay, so that was the first kind of example. It's based in projective representations. You can see it with your eyes in this particle on the circle. And let me now give you another more subtle class of example. I advertised that we would use the anti-unitary symmetry, so let's do it. So the other class of example that I'll do today are, so it's real fermions with T symmetry. So psi I of T will be classically Grassmann. You know you've made it as a physicist or mathematician when your name can be demoted to lowercase. So I here will go from 1 to n. And for simplicity in this example, since I'm running out of time, we'll take big N to be even. So these fermions are quantized into Clifford algebra. So we promote them to operators, obeying canonical anti-commutation relations. like so. And what's the T action? T psi I T inverse is, I believe, minus psi I of minus T. Okay, what is there to say? Well, the dimension of this Hilbert space is finite in this problem. We're looking for a representation of this Clifford algebra. So the dimension, if you remember your Clifford algebra, is 2 to the n over 2, the minimum dimension. And the Hamiltonian is just 0 to start with. So all states are degenerate. So our goal is to try to understand how robust that degeneracy is. Okay, so one proceeds in steps. The first thing is, if you have a bunch of fermions, or more generally fields, and you want to try to make some of them split some degeneracy, you should try to add a mass term. Mass term is a quadratic term in the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian. So we could try to add take delta H to be I M psi 1, psi 2, where M needs to be real in order for this to be self-adjoint. So naively, if we were allowed to add this, this would allow us to remove pairs of these fermions, so to move up their energy eigenvalues. But this is obstructed by the T symmetry. So T delta H, T inverse, is equal to minus delta H. And here, to get that minus sign, you crucially need to use the fact that T is an anti-unitary symmetry. There's an I here. Pay attention to this I. So T invariance prohibits us from adding this kind of quadratic deformation. So things can only start getting interesting with quartic deformations. Okay, there's really no chance of me finishing this. So if you really want to study quartic deformations, you need to group the fermions into complex pairs. So you introduce the standard creation and annihilation operators. So that's a fermionic annihilation operator, and they obey An Am dagger is delta Mn. The advantage of this is that you can present this representation of this Clifford algebra very explicitly. So each pair of psis generates a two-component Hilbert space. So So we usually call them W plus and minus, and they are acted on in the usual way. A annihilates W minus. A dagger on W minus is W plus. And the conjugate relations. So then a general state looks like W plus minus, etc. And there are here N over 2 labels. Okay, so let me conclude by just sort of stating the result for you. So the first Bordic deformation you would try is something like that, where Q is a real parameter. Let's say Q is greater than 0. And if you work it out, this delta H looks like minus Q, A1 dagger minus a half, A2 dagger minus a half. So for the aligned states, that is W plus plus and W minus minus, the change in energy is minus Q, they go down. And for the anti-aligned states, W plus minus and W minus plus, they go up. So we still end up with a twofold degeneracy. So with n equals 4, you cannot lift all the degeneracy in a t-preserving way. But you can do it with 8. So maybe I'll just say that, or as a homework, show that with n equals 8, there exists a T invariant quartic deformation leading to a unique ground state. So there is some kind of mod 8 phenomenon. So this number N that we started with, the number of fermions, N mod 8 is protected by T. And this is another example of an anomaly. So how to fit this phenomena into the particle on the circle phenomena is not at all obvious. But one of the things that we'll develop over the next couple lectures is some kind of framework which incorporates both of these examples and many more. Okay, so I'll stop here. I'm way over time. Okay, there are probably lots of questions about this, so go for it.
The talk. And so my question is pretty simple. So what happens if you have an odd number of fermions?
That case has to be treated a bit differently, but you definitely can't gap it in a T-invariant way, because the only things you're allowed to add in the Hamiltonian are even.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question in the chat here.
Yeah.
About the first example, maybe this is a basic question, but what does it mean that states have a cocycle?
They are in a projective representation of O2 with that cocycle. Right, every projective representation comes with a particular cocycle. Yeah.
So I had a question with the theta term.
Yeah.
Did we lose anything by not considering T symmetry in that case?
Did I lose anything?
It's because the Hamiltonian was also invariant under T.
At theta equals zero and pi. You lose a little bit in figuring out which class of deformations the degeneracy is robust under.
Yeah, and I guess I had another question. The word anomaly here, is this like the same anomaly that you learn about in like, you know, standard QFT textbook?
Yes, I intend by the end of this lecture to the end of the series to convince you of that. So this phenomenon is one and the same with the ones that you learn about in QFT textbooks. But we need to develop a kind of big framework that can encompass both this and that.
In the previous example, if you instead declare that your symmetry is pin 2, this is not a projective representation. No? So what is the reason why you have to say, oh, my symmetry is O2 and this is projective? Is there an intrinsic way to see this?
So I'm trying to emphasize there are different ways to proceed, but one thing to note is the difference between the way the symmetry acts on the operators versus the states. So that is an invariant difference. So the way I was using the word, I was defining the symmetry to be what you see when you act on the operators.
Okay.
And then you ask the question of, do the states see the same symmetry, or do they see a central extension of that symmetry?
Okay.
So that's the way I was phrasing it.
Okay, so if also the operator realized the projective representation, we would not say that it's projective.
No, because you see, exactly, yeah. So, you're correct. So, what is being emphasized here is the discrepancy between the states and the operators.
Okay, clear.
All the operators are seeing mu equals vanishing cocycle, and all the states are seeing some one fixed cocycle. That's the situation that describes an anomaly.
Is there a similar discrepancy in this second example?
No, I don't know. This example is beyond the framework of group cohomology and projective representations. It requires a more sophisticated notion of an anomaly, but indeed one that we'll hopefully get to.
Sorry, I still have a question because you said that it is really the fact that you are realizing that representation which imply that the ground state is degenerate because there is no one-dimensional representation. So suppose we have a system in which both the operators and the states are realizing that case, we would still have a degenerate ground state because there is no one-dimensional representation.
You could by tuning the Hamiltonian, but you would not in general have it.
Okay, so this would not be robust.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe just to clarify the conclusion on the second example, what were we able to lift and what weren't we during the deformation that we produced? So with the quadratic one, what did we lose?
The quadratic deformation was obstructed by T. As long as T is a symmetry, you're not allowed to write that in the Hamiltonian. So that was the first thing. T conjugates that to minus itself. So the only invariant point is m equals 0. If you add the, if you have n equals 4 and you add this quartic term, so there's a little bit of algebra to convince yourself that this is equal to this. And then you break some of the degeneracy. So you used to have 4 degenerate ground states, and now you have 2 degenerate ground states. So 2 of them go down in energy and 2 of them go up in energy, but there's no way to split them any further. And then the magic thing that happens for n equals 8 is that you can exhibit a quartic deformation that that leads to a unique ground state.
So we can choose specifically one that leads to a unique ground state.
Yes.
It will not.
It's actually a quartic deformation, but one that involves a certain pattern of the indices here.
That involves a certain pattern of the indices?
Well, you know, it'll be like psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4, plus psi 1, psi 2, psi 7, psi 8, plus, you know, you'll have to kind of carefully figure out which exact quartic term you want to add, such that in the end, you're left with a unique ground state. And this is all preserving T. So, in other words, these T invariant fermions can be removed in units of 8. So there's a mod 8 invariant here to n. That 8 is the same 8 that occurs in all other studies of Clifford algebras.
I have another question from the chat, Clay. So can we view the time reversal symmetry operator in quantum mechanics as an insertion of some defect?
I think the answer is yes in general, but if you press me on all the details, especially in quantum field theory as opposed to quantum mechanics, I may squirm. So I think the answer is yes.
This fact that this 8 is the same 8 which appear in the of
not in this lecture, but in the later lecture. Yes. So eventually, hopefully, I will give you a framework where you can see in a more explicit way what this invariant was, and then we'll see a little bit more that structure. Okay. Right now, it's just kind of an amorphous union of ideas. You have a Clifford algebra, you have an 8. You should suspect that it's the same 8. Yeah, you should expect that it's the same 8, that it's all, that's always the same 8, but I didn't give you anything to really connect onto that yet.
Hey, if there are no further questions for Clay, we can all go for coffee.